All right, thanks for coming out. Obviously, getting late in the day here, and we're going to try to run through the slides here as quickly as we can so we can then get to discussion. So if you got questions, it may seem antisocial, but try to hold them until we get towards a little closer to the end. And the reason I say that is just because otherwise we're going to miss some of the definitional stuff if we don't get through the bulk of the slides, and those could end up answering some of your questions here as we go. All right. First, we're going to do some little introductions. So, Dave, who are you?
My name is Dave Nevada. I am the attorney of this talk. I'm a founding partner of the Information Law Group and a co-chair of the American Bar Association's Information Security Committee. On this topic, I often get called into companies to sort of act as a translator between the security team and the general counsel or our tech lawyer team, trying to figure out a lot of security compliance-related issues, a lot of contracting issues. And I'm able to kind of speak both languages pretty well, and that's what one of the big things I do, and that's how I got into this area.
Cool. And I'm Ben Tomhave. I've been doing the security shtick for about 15 years now. Been at a number of companies, and Dave is one of the co-chairs of the American Bar Association Information Security Committee, and I'm now one of the co-vice chairs of that same committee. So we're trying to become a 1-2 punch here of Dave sets them up, and then I cut their technical knees out from underneath them.
Yeah, I go in for all technical questions as
yeah,
well.
Right, so yeah. But so anyways, getting into things here. So just the facts, ma'am, nothing but the facts, right? The question is not if we're going to come under attack or if we're going to have legal issues associated with cyber security. The question is when, right? Does anybody question that or at this, 2010? Peanut Gallery says maybe. Another key factor here, right, is that legal costs are getting increasing dramatically, right? And I think we're going to continue to see that because of the third bullet there, that the regulatory burden is only going to increase at this point in time, right? So what this causes, at least for us as security practitioners, is that now we're going to start dealing increasingly with having a lot of legal issues, which is a completely foreign realm to us, right? This creates a problem, right, Dave?
Yes. There is definitely going on a collision right now between legal and security. It has been going on for some time. Some companies have been kind of ahead of the curve and started to address it before it's become an acute problem, but now I believe it's become an acute problem. There are more regulations, more lawsuits, and more contractual obligations that deal with information security that organizations need to comply with. As a result, security professionals are making decisions on a daily basis that impact those legal obligations. But the problem, of course, is that there's not always a conversation between legal and security. They don't necessarily know what each other are doing when it comes to making these decisions. And what that leads to, essentially, is legal risk for organizations. The bigger problem is there are multiple legal regimes that exist, a lot of different obligations. So on the regulatory side, there are state, federal, and international laws. Even small organizations now with a web presence who collect data from multiple jurisdictions could trigger multiple jurisdictional requirements. These laws overlap. They're confusing. It's difficult sometimes to even know which laws apply to you as an organization unless you know where your data is and you know where that data is going to. As a result, there could be regulatory enforcement, which we've seen a lot of from the FTC, attorney generals. There could also be private enforcement. Some of these laws might provide litigants like consumers or employees with private rights of action to go after organizations that suffer security breach or fail to comply. Independently, contract law, creating obligations and liability. Tort law, the concept of whether or not you have reasonable security in place. The same law that is used to sue people who allow someone to slip and fall on their property could be used to sue someone who fails to maintain information. And then in another kind of category, securities law. Heartland payment processors got sued in securities for misrepresenting the level of security they had in place. After that big breach they suffered, their stock value dropped, and their shareholders sued them for misrepresenting that security because it was so integral to the organization. That one was dismissed, but it was filed. So that was the first real major shareholder lawsuit that I saw of a security breach.
Why was it dismissed?
that. I do not know the exact basis for the dismissal, but apparently they felt they didn't plead the cause of action properly. Legal defensibility. So what is that? It's a security discipline, but it involves a combination of legal and security. It's viewing the requirements of your security requirements, your security process from an external legal perspective. How would a plaintiff, judge, jury, or regulator look at the decisions that you make as a security professional or an organization? So your security choices ultimately become legal positions. If there's an area where you're not sure or there's a gray area and you make a choice to do X, you may have to defend that position in court. So part of legal defensibility is just security decision-making with legal baked into the decision-making process. And the ultimate goal is to anticipate reasonable risks and reduce those legal risks before you get bit.
And before we go next slide, that third bullet is pretty important, right? Supporting the decision-making processes. This is where a lot of our higher-level subsets of the industry are going. Risk analysis is a good example. We used to look at risk as, oh, this panacea, we can measure stuff and then life is grand. Now it's really seen more as supporting decision analysis and making decisions better, right? This is the same thing, right? We need to provide better accountability before we can go and make well-informed decisions, right?
And we'll get into it a little bit more, but what the law looks at not necessarily is the result, although the result is important. It looks at the process. In a lot of cases, you're going to be defending yourself as an organization after you've suffered a security breach, so the result is already kind of bad. So then the courts don't expect perfect security. That's a good thing. However, your back's kind of against the wall if you don't have a process in place that shows that you went through a proper decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. Oops, did we just do two slides? Or do we do it? Okay. So we're going to talk now a little bit about, well, not a little, probably a lot, right, about what this legal defensibility concept means in practice, all right? So we're going to talk about key attributes, real-world examples, some recommended steps, and action plan. And that gets into that proactive, right? How can we use legal defensibility as a risk management tool to then proactively protect organizations? First, let's do a sidebar, though. Does anybody recognize who this is? This is Elio Gracie. He's the namesake of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Left us about 18 months ago. But he provides a good analogy for what we are kind of dealing with here in security, right? We're trying to achieve, instead of trying to, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. I think all of us probably accept this now. Instead, it's more about trying to survive. And this is something that Elio really taught us. A lot of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu actually focuses on just surviving. If you're going to get attacked, you want to survive it. It's not so much about winning. He used to say, even in his 90s, no matter what level of skill of a student might come in, he could say to them, "You won't beat me." But that's a very distinct difference from saying, "I can beat you," right? And this is the mentality we need to start adapting within the security industry, and as well as at the government level as well. You know, survivability talks about two key attributes: one is defensibility, and the other one being recoverability. So when I started developing this legal defensibility notion, you know, I was looking at the survivability theory, which says, you know, yes, we can do a certain number of things to defend our organizations against attack, but ultimately, any attacker who is willing to invest the time and money, they will get through, right? And so if or when they get through, we need to have mechanisms and processes in place to more quickly and adequately recover. At the same time, talking about survivability also comes along the notion of resilience. Our businesses now, especially in the United States, are very heavily dependent on our internet presence, right? So when bad things happen, we need to continue functioning. And so resilience and survivability talk about allowing you to continue to operate under degraded situations until you can recover back to your optimal operating position. Now, the challenge is, how do you codify that into federal law, right, or even international law? How do you take this notion of legal defensibility and not have it end up as something that's fairly watered down, like a Sarbanes-Oxley, something that is only now starting to be enforced, like HIPAA and HITECH, or something that's very prescriptive in nature, like PCI-DSS, which then has a significant shortcomings because it doesn't necessarily go far enough in certain areas. And so we'll kind of talk about that a little bit here too. Some key attributes then of legal defensibility. First and foremost, it's really a risk management strategy. Okay. You still have to do analysis. You still have to make quality decisions. You still have to have operations. But it contributes to your risk management approach, allowing you to make a more foreseeable, more reasonable path to the future. Another key attribute here is awareness, understanding, and translation, right? We can't afford to have techies sitting in silos, or business people sitting in silos, or lawyers sitting in silos and not talking to each other, right? We need legal, we need security, we need the business all sitting at the same table, all on the same page, having conversations that they understand with each other, right? And that really gets to that third point of collaboration, right? If you, regardless of what your political motivations might be within your organization, ultimately, you should all be pulling towards the greater good, at least of the corporation, right? Towards the bottom line, at least in theory, right? If you appreciate your job and want to continue getting a paycheck, you know, the survival of your employer is probably a beneficial thing both to you and to them. And so if we can build off of that mutually beneficial situation, it's a positive.
So beyond collaboration and the kind of the underpinnings of this, you have to have a documentation process. And there's two aspects of this. First, as I talked about earlier, what will be scrutinized by regulators and courts is your decision-making process as an organization when it comes to security. So understanding and baking a legal due diligence aspect into that security process is very important and codifying that within the organization. So you can show, here are the steps we took, here are the steps we normally took. It creates consistency across the organization, and it also creates a document that shows that you're not just doing things on an ad hoc basis. Beyond that, there may be decisions you have to make as an organization for high-risk kind of security decisions or security decisions and regulatory decisions where there's gray areas as to what controls you might need to implement or what policies you need to implement. And those decisions also should be documented. And this can be done under an attorney-client privilege, potentially, within the organization. What that allows you to do is basically talk frankly with your legal team and your security team all together about some deficiencies you may have without worrying about those deficiencies being exposed in court or in a regulatory process. So here are some real-world examples of where legal defensibility comes in. Right now, there are tons of HHS, Health and Human Service investigations around HIPAA, and the new high tech requires that they all be, any breaches over 500 records be put up online, and there are audits being done all the time. The fact of the matter is a lot of those investigations never get to a formal investigation phase and never get to an action phase. And how does this happen? Well, the organizations that maybe suffer a breach or have some problems have arguments, legal arguments, as to why they did certain things and can justify their actions such that the regulators say, okay, you guys were doing enough, this was an anomaly of some sort, and we're not going to do anything. The people without processes in place, without a step-by-step ability to show regulators what they did and why they did it, are the ones who are going to get actions filed against them. So that's an area where legal defensibility is coming in. There have been some online banking cases. These two right here involved basically the thieves getting the online credentials of some small businesses and transferring money out of their account. The Shane Jaco case looked at guidance put out by regulators. It's guidance. It wasn't mandatory. It wasn't a law. However, it was guidance. And the court really relied on that guidance and almost treated it like a requirement as opposed to guidance because it wasn't intended to be a mandatory type of thing. And again, as a security professional, as you're developing your security program and you look at a guidance, you might not think or might not put the proper weight on that guidance when it comes to developing your program, and that can get you into trouble. So both those cases are examples of where following the guidance may be beneficial. And this one here, the Gwynne versus Brazos Higher Education, involved a GLB situation where the plaintiffs were arguing that the defendant failed to encrypt data, personal information on a laptop that was eventually stolen. And the defendants were trying to argue that, or the plaintiffs were trying to argue that as a matter of law, because it wasn't encrypted, there was a violation of GLB. The court said, no, there are other controls in place, and we felt that they were reasonable. Just because it wasn't encrypted doesn't necessarily mean you violated the statute. Again, having that process in place, even though you may have missed a control, can give you arguments as to why you should escape liability. Another example, PCI is a security standard many are aware of and deal with on a regular basis. And even the words in the statute or the PCI standard itself can be ambiguous. The ones I've highlighted, I've had to deal with in various situations. I had a situation involving people that for a company would go in to and have these at-home kind of product demonstrations, and they weren't really employees of this company, but they were definitely taking credit card information on behalf of the company. So was there a sharing going on in this case? It was the individual consumers giving it to these independent contractors who would then go and put it into a computer and buy the products from a client. Were these individual service providers? Did all these other things have to be put in place? 12.82, maintain a written agreement that includes acknowledgement of security. Some people think you can do a letter, for instance. It's a letter from the general counsel or a letter from some person in the organization. Does that constitute a written agreement? If your service provider gets nailed, will you be in violation of 12.82? 12.83, doing a due diligence process. You have to have an established process and you have to have proper due diligence. What does that mean exactly? And PCI counsel doesn't really say. And these matters, when they get into court, can have significant impact on whether the organization is found liable ultimately. So again, thinking about it from a plaintiff's attorney's point of view, PCI again, there are over 200 sections of PCI. If you go and suffer a breach, and if you actually have gone through the PCI process, but you have taken some shortcuts, or you've looked at some gray areas and made some choices that don't comply with a strict interpretation to the letter of PCI, maybe you've had some compensating controls for some sections of PCI, for instance, you may have reasonable security. But you're going to be in the yellow zone there from a plaintiff's attorney point of view. They're going to say, well, you didn't comply with the letter of PCI, and that's what they're going to try to use to leverage themselves in the court and to leverage themselves down the line in the litigation. So you have to think of these things ahead of time and how these things may be looked at if you ever get into trouble. So some other key legal issues. A lot of statutes use terms like reasonable, appropriate, comprehensive, adequate, and a lot of security departments go and say, yeah, our security is reasonable, yeah, it's comprehensive, or it's adequate, without necessarily knowing what these words mean in the legal context. There are ways to find out and ways to analyze what these words mean. It may be legislative history, it may be case law, but the word by themselves, it's not very helpful as a decision-making factor as a security professional. Risk-based factors. Some standards and laws have factors that say basically if you are a smaller company and don't have a lot of resources, you may not have to comply strictly or comply fully with a particular law, or you may be able to do a slimmer set of controls in the law mandates. The problem, of course, how do you balance these risk-based factors? If you're a small company with little resources but tons of sensitive data, what kind of security do you need to have in place? If you're a large organization with low volumes of sensitive data, do you still have higher obligations because you have more resources? Again, there's a legal analysis that goes on as to how you balance these particular factors. Vendors, another key area for outsourcing relationship, cloud relationships. I help a lot of clients when they're putting that information on third-party systems. Are you doing a due diligence, a security assessment of those systems? Are you looking at your own security and the risk you're taking internally, and are you making sure that your service provider is reducing that risk in the same way that you are? Because if you go to a service provider who has less security or reduces the risk in a lesser amount, they're going to be judged against your own internal security. So you have to make sure that those two match up. And if they don't match for whatever reason, you have to document why it doesn't matter or why the risk is low or what have you.
How many of you work with third parties? Do you guys do assessments of all of your third parties?
Yeah.
Well, have you been assessed as a third party?
We provide assessments.
Right. Yeah.
Another big challenge, again, if you're working in the security department, and even the legal department for that matter, what legal obligations actually apply to the organization? A multinational company now has dozens and dozens of potential legal obligations that it must comply with. It's sometimes difficult to even know what those obligations are unless you sit down, track your data, understand your processes. Interpretation by courts and regulators. How is a court or a regulator going to look at what you're doing? Are they going to look at the guidance and put heavy weight on that guidance? Or are they going to take a more a broader view of security, like as a security department might, and say, you know, even though we didn't follow the guidance necessarily, we had controls in place that compensated for the risk? Foreseeability. Ben, you want to talk about that?
Well, so, Dave, what is this? You mentioned the word reasonable has a problem. What about foreseeability? What does foreseeability mean in the legal context?
The issue is whether or not you have a duty to do something or not. What kind of duties and security do you have? How far do you have to go? And foreseeability goes to the aspect of harm. Is a particular harm foreseeable under the law? And if it is, you may have a duty or an obligation to address that harm as an organization.
But I've seen Star Trek, you know, and there's potentially alien life out there. Is that something that's reasonably foreseeable? Do we need to plan for things like that?
Well, the problem with foreseeability is it's often based on kind of a community industry type of standard. You got to understand what other organizations that are similar to you are doing. That is one aspect of foreseeability. Foreseeability also can be the various alerts and information you receive as a security professional about threats that exist. And how, you know, then looking at your own organization and determine whether those threats are actually viable threats or threats that pose significant risk. So you have to look at both the kind of the current environment as well as what everyone else is. It's kind of a herd mentality on the foreseeability side. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the indicia in a second.
Right. So, and thinking kind of like the attacker is what we do in security oftentimes, at least when we try to do some of this threat assessment stuff. Thinking like a plaintiff can be very helpful too, can it?
Right. Yeah, you have to know, and both the next two go together, plaintiff attorney strategies, litigation strategy. And for the PCI example, a plaintiff is going to try to take a very strict interpretation of PCI and say, you need to have all of these things in place, X, Y, and Z. If you deviate from that and you've suffered a breach, even if you've had compensating controls, it's your obligation, your burden as an organization to prove that you address the risk for those that those compensating controls were intended to address. They're going to try to get the litigation further along. There's a concept called the motion to dismiss, the motion for summary judgment, which are early hurdles that allow some defendants to get their cases thrown out of court. And if you can win those, that's great. However, they're going to do everything in their power to further the litigation because the closer you get to trial, the more risk you suffer as an organization. So understanding what they will try to do with respect to security breach litigation is very important. And that ties right into litigation strategy and procedure.
If you're a defendant, getting your case tossed out right away, that's probably a pretty valuable thing, right?
Right.
And that's where legal defensibility comes into play. If you can already show a whole string of quality decisions being made, how does that build your case?
The more precedent you have, the better you can make your case. I mean, there are certainly, you got to think about not only precedent from a legal standpoint, but also within your own organization, making sure that you're doing things on a consistent basis. If you want to actually prove that you've actually complied and that you have legal defensibility, here are the things as an organization you should try to have in place. As Ben mentioned, risk analysis and remediation. The law recognizes the concept of risk and reducing risk. Security professionals also do that on a regular basis. So those two things kind of go hand in hand.
Or at least we pretend to on a regular basis.
Right? But you want to be able to show that you've gone through some sort of analysis, that at the bare minimum, whatever inexpensive controls that reduce a lot of risk, you should have those in place as an organization. You shouldn't pass on those. Other controls that may be more expensive, that may be reduced risk on the margin, you know, those may not necessarily be required in the legal context. Compliance with your own policies, this one seems to be common sense, but actually I see a lot of companies, actually a lot of big companies, who they develop a centralized security policy for the whole organization, maybe the corporate body, and then there may be the 20 subsidiaries, and there may be some subsidiaries who aren't able to, you know, actually physically comply with some of these policies. So regardless of whether your policies are reasonable or good or bad, if you can't comply with your own policies, that's going to get you in trouble as an organization. Misrepresentations. Work with your legal team to make sure that you aren't, as an organization, overstating your security. This happens in the privacy policy context, which often has a representation about how secure you are as an organization, how you secure private information. If you overstate the case and you suffer a breach, that misrepresentation could be a cause of action against you, regardless of whether the security was reasonable or not reasonable. Specific controls. We've come to a point in the statutory world where now we started out with laws that required appropriate or reasonable or comprehensive types of controls, which allowed for some decision-making and some leeway and some fudge factor. Now we're getting, in some states like Massachusetts and Nevada, laws that require specific controls be in place. Like,
how many states have adopted all or part of PCI as the regulation?
Only Nevada has adopted all of it, but there are a few states that have laws that relate to PCI that allow recovery, but they incorporate certain sections of PCI.
Didn't Washington just pass a law?
Yeah, but if you validate your PCI compliance and you suffer a breach, then the banks can't go after you. But if you haven't validated, then they can go after you. It doesn't per se require PCI compliance. It gives the banks a remedy if you aren't PCI compliant. Right. Nevada, though, if you have credit card information, they've basically incorporated PCI into their law. And as a security requirement to satisfy their law, you need to be PCI compliant. So I don't know if this is going to be a trend. We only have a few states now that are doing this. But if we have 50 states, for instance, that pass laws that require, you know, a laundry list of various controls, things could be very confusing going forward.
So it's going to be tough keeping your ducks in a row then. Huh?
That's right. Yeah. The ducks. Vendor management, we talked about that a second ago. The key here is, as an organization, you make certain choices, you reduce your risk to a certain level. The minute you give your information to a third party, you're completely relying on their resources, their security. And if you go with someone who has lesser security, who's not compliant with various laws or regulations, and they suffer a breach, as an organization, you might be held responsible. For that touch point right there is very important to make sure you have your due diligence and contracts in place. And I work very closely with security professionals, not only developing the vendor management program, but also actually negotiating the contracts themselves. I've sat on many, many long calls with people trying to work out security terms. Compliance with standards. On this one, courts, if you can show that you are compliant with a independent, peer-reviewed standard, like an ISO standard, in court, that's going to be very valuable because they basically create this standard at an objective level. There's no kind of subjective aspect to it except for perhaps scope. Then you want to also look at not only general standards, but industry standards. If you're a bank, you want to look at what other players in the industry are doing. But even more importantly, you want to look within that industry at your peers. So if you're a Citibank, your obligations are probably going to be a lot different than if you're a mom-and-pop credit union. So you want to make sure you comply with industry standards, peer standards, and if you can show that you comply with general standards, you'll have more strength in court if you ever get hit with a lawsuit or a regulatory action.
Sounding pretty expensive. But we all have endless sources of money that we work with here, right?
Well, my security budget has no bounds.
Right, yeah, exactly. Multiply it by a million and it's still fine because, you know, when you start with zero is your base number. Yeah. As long as you don't divide by it.
So basically, how do you do this?
This is a big challenge, right? And this is a perfect lead-in here from Mark, our designated heckler in the front, right? That the whole point behind this legal defensibility is to say there's only so much time, there's only so much money that you can do stuff with, right? So when something bad happens and somebody decides to sue you, how do you come back to them and say, we really did do the best we could, right? And this is really kind of the basis. So some of the recommended steps we talk about here is, you know, first and foremost, you're going to need to find a champion in your organization, somebody who can really lead this cause of, okay, security, cool, but we need security plus legal plus business, right? We need that collaboration. We need the communication, which then needs to lead to better informed decisions using legal analysis, risk analysis, and then documentation of these decisions. And on top of it all, you're going to probably need a fairly well-defined process that you can point to and say, this is how we went through making decisions. Now, this sounds like bureaucracy, right? We got to be careful. It's got to be a balance because we can't afford to sit in meetings all day long like we already do because there's not enough hours in the day to add any more meetings, right? So your champion needs to go out and find allies. You need to start making some of these points and get some analysis performed right away. The best way you can start demonstrating value over time is that you got to show put your first stake in the ground, right? Until you do that, you won't be able to know where you are, let alone where you want to go to. That will allow you to create a better strategy, right? And then that last bullet, hopefully lead to quality execution supported with documentation, right? Because discovery is one of the first things that you're going to start dealing with if someone starts suing you, right? And if you can turn around and say, have my documentation, here's the decision process we went through, especially if, you know, stakeholders, people that have a direct interest in your financial performance as an organization, if you can come back and say, we were being fiscally responsible, here's how, you're going to make a lot more progress right?
And documentation is not only the process, showing them the process, but also the documentation you have about the tough decisions you had to make in this organization in conjunction with security. And those documents you don't want to show to the court. Those are the ones you want to try to protect under attorney-client privilege.
And that's a good point, right? It's very important to engage your legal counsel so that you can start covering a lot of these conversations under that attorney-client privilege,
yeah,
right?
And it's not foolproof by any stretch, and you have to be very careful about it. But what it does is allows you to put you're basically memorializing your thought process. So if something happens down the line, you kind of know what you went through. you can try to anticipate potential defenses based on the decisions you're making. So you can have maybe a roadmap to defend yourself if you ever get hit with something. And again, if it's protected, it's something that you can then, you know, you can use as a document to help you guide through this legal liability process.
Two things. One, this is sounding more like a governance objective than anything else at this point.
Yeah, governance directed. Like I said, it's almost a risk management strategy, because if you look at risk not only from the security that nebulous security perspective, but also from a legal risk perspective and a business risk perspective, which, by the way, the business risk should hopefully be the far more important one, even or financial risk, of which there are legal risk components, right? You need to be able to proactively manage that as best as possible. And governance certainly comes into play, right? That's ultimately probably what you're right. That's what we're talking about.
Probably a GRC.
Built into the process, but it involves kind of hands-on. It impacts the ultimate decisions you make as far as how security
works. I just
try
not to say GRC because it usually makes marketing people pop out of the weeds and all the security people to go,
Yeah. So. You need to have like a cross or something.
Right.
The other question I had was...
Chrome browser, will that count instead of a Chrome cross? Okay, sorry, never mind.
the attorney-client privilege. Now, doesn't the court
Yeah, yes. Well, you have to be very careful because to the extent that they are assisting with business decisions as opposed to legal decisions, that information may be discoverable. So you have to make sure that you put it in the right context, all this process.
That's the
thing
that
has
counsel. If you deal with external...
Well, even with external counsel, you got to make sure you put it in the right context. It's riskier, certainly riskier with in-house counsel because... they actually helped make business decisions on a kind of regular basis. And you had to be very careful, and it's certainly not foolproof. I mean, I wouldn't say that in any sense. You got to be, even when you're documenting your tough decisions and how you went through them, you have to be very careful as to what you put in there because you have to make sure, yeah, there may be situations where if it's so sensitive that you would want no chance of it ever being discoverable, you would have conversations and work things out that way.
Yep.
Sorry, I was just going to... You get very easily into these situations where, you know, if you're the security person or the privacy person or whatever it is, and have these conversations, if it comes down to litigation or that potential conflict of interest where the company is not going to necessarily be aligned with the employee's interest.
That's the case with all corporate lawyers.
It is.
Yeah. So... at this point, I would say definitely Q&A is full on. If you have additional questions and stuff, we're going to talk through a little bit of an action plan, how you can implement some of those recommended steps here. It's almost like exploring space, right? These first conversations are going to be a lot like walking on the moon for the first time. You know, security people who may come up may actually know what colors are, or they may just know what black is, right? Your legal team, who probably they're wearing nice suits that are tailored. No. And their business team that are probably on the golf course and too busy to attend, right? So, I'm just kidding. How do we get that first stakeholder meeting going?
Well, I mean, that's where the champion comes in. And actually, interestingly, I think personally, there's more kind of awareness oftentimes on the security side than the legal side, especially when it comes to true general counsel. Some tech counsel may have awareness of data security issues, but we get brought in oftentimes by the security team to actually kind of lay the groundwork to have this conversation with the legal team to basically impress upon them how, you know, basically we're making these decisions. This could impact, you know, the legal risk of the organization. We don't talk to you ever. Let's start having this conversation. So I think from a champion arises standpoint, it's oftentimes coming from the legal or the security side as opposed to legal.
This is kind of scary as I study risk analysis and do research in this area, and that one of the things that we've found is that security people are really bad at doing actual risk analysis because we're terrible at estimating the business impacts. And to me, I think it's great that the security teams are now proactively reaching out to the legal teams, because I think that finally acknowledges that, hey, guess what? Security teams, we're not lawyers. Right? I'm certainly not a lawyer. That's why I, you know, want Dave up here to tell me when I can or can't color outside the lines, right?
Right. So beyond that, then the next step is, you know, once you have your meetings, you got to figure out the lay of the land. What obligations do we have? And again, I've said it already many times, but that can be a daunting, difficult process. And some people, when they start down that process, say, I don't want to go any further because
and the ambiguity,
box.
That ambiguity in regulations that Dave talked about earlier, man, that can be a real pain. I was at one of my former employers, and our general counsel swore up and down that we were subject to GLBA because we let our customers pay in arrears after, we invoiced them at the end of the month, and that was essentially, in his mind,
red flags,
and well, this has predated red flags a little bit, but at least it was extending credit, right? Man, talk about opening a whole can of worms.
The problem, again, it's multiple jurisdictions, multiple legal requirements, all overlapping. Difficult. For a big multinational company distributed, it's 100% compliance is not something you try to, it's a goal that's aspirational at best.
Safe harbor, if you're a multinational, heaven help you, right? How are you going to find definitions in multiple countries, especially European countries, that you can actually meet those requirements and the U.S. requirements? Well, maybe the other way around, right?
So once you figure out what applies, then you look at your security and see if it's actually addressing those requirements.
Then what?
Then conduct a legal defensibility analysis.
Oh, heaven help us now. Dave and I had a debate going earlier. We couldn't decide if that was the lawyer being chased out by the security team or if that's just the security team in general on a daily basis taking arrows. It's probably a little bit of both. So once you've started to get that basis in place of what are our actual legal obligations, what specific things do we have to address, now you can start sitting down and having reasonably knowledgeable conversations about what can we reasonably do to meet those obligations, right?
And how are we going to bake this legal analysis into the process, essentially,
yeah,
at the end of the day?
Which hopefully you have processes.
This is kind of a meta, the first bullet is a meta issue. It's you're looking at, we have legal issues, the security team is making decisions, some of these decisions are material to those legal issues. When do we have to get together and talk about them and work them out as an organization?
Right. So I'm a product. Okay.
I'm sorry. Vendor scum, right?
Yeah. And I have a development process that essentially is, here's some customer requirements, get a bunch of coders, make a product. There's no legal analysis there's no security analysis or security lifecycle analysis built into that process. Now, I've talked to a couple of attorneys, mostly because I got trapped in a room and couldn't get out. They are investigating ways to deal with that is class action lawsuits. It sounds like this is creeping up on that very process.
Well,
once this begins to take hold, now it seems like, okay, while you have a business security process, and other people are being, prosecuted.
Yeah.
And I use the term from a military perspective. Why couldn't this extend to the product companies?
Two things here. One, the idea here is something proactive, right? So we can start preempting some of these things. The second point, though, goes back to that question, how do we codify this? How do we put this into a federal law, right? And I think ultimately what I've come to is that I think if you start, we'll have to rely on fuzzy words, right? But if you can put it into the court's hands to start better evaluating and building case law around what is reasonably foreseeable, and what is a reasonable standard of care? That's something we didn't put in, a phrase we didn't put in the slide deck here, but reasonable standard of care relates to, doing what is actually appropriate in terms of your peers and current standards of performance, right?
But so I would much rather rely on lawyers than legislators.
Well, I don't know if a law is the way to go. I think this is a process that needs to be built in, and I think over time it will work itself out. Your product example, they're going to be becoming aware of these issues because they're going to be asked by potential customers whether they've gone through certain of their own processes.
So far for the last 15 years, they've gone to court, people have been sued, and they've been dismissed.
Well, right, and that's where the law is going to have to come into place, is to create the liability situation and create a case for damage.
Right.
But did they cover this?
And we are getting further. So you're talking about the consumer suits that get dismissed relatively early, and that's on a very technical legal issue as to whether they've suffered any harm. We're just starting to get some lawsuits that look at the concept of reasonable security, and they actually are the online banking suits I talked about before, whether they had commercially reasonable security in place.
But if those could
be
Well, we've had a couple decisions now. One looking at the FFEIC guidance as requiring two-factor authentication for online banking. We have another one that went through a motion for summary judgment, which actually the concept of reasonable security was looked at by the court, but what happened was is that the banking customer agreed in the contract that the bank's security was reasonable.
That was EMI versus Comerica,
yeah.
Right?
So they didn't actually look at the security, the court. They didn't analyze, unfortunately, objectively whether it was good security or not. They just said, well, you, customer, agreed. Basically, you agreed that it was reasonable. Therefore, we're going to say, as a matter of law, it was reasonable.
Yep.
Which, unfortunately, I was hoping to get a little more guidance as to how they would go through that decision-making process. Didn't work. But again, a perfect example of making sure your contract basically says, you know, you agree, you know, have your customers agree that your security is reasonable. That, as a vendor, you're going to potentially avoid some liability. And now we know that.
But then I look at...
Yeah.
But then I look at cases like Hannaford, like the grocery store chain in Maine, where customers even knew that their credit cards were compromised, but they couldn't show actual damages. They bore no burden, right, of damage. And so those cases also got dismissed right out of hand as well.
Yeah,
and that, I think, is where we really have a gap in terms of there needs to be something that creates that liability to help pressure the industry.
Well, where there is liability, are even though the credit card lawsuits have not been very successful,
right,
all the credit card breaches are getting worked out in the back end because basically the card bank, the merchant banks are going to go after the merchants using the Visa and MasterCard's operating regulations, which allow for certain types of recoveries. And they don't even really need to have a lawsuit or sue because they have so much leverage over the merchants right now because they can basically say, well, you know, if you're not going to pay this fine or penalty or pay this recovery cost, we're going to take away your ability to, you know, use credit cards, which is the lifeline of many companies these days. Not to mention all their contracts are very one-sided, so all these merchants have essentially agreed more or less that if they suffer a breach and they're not PCI compliant, that they will pay. So the concept of PCI compliance becomes very important in that case. Unfortunately, again, you're having one of Visa or MasterCard's assessors come in post-breach and making that determination as to whether you were PCI compliant or not. And if they, a lot of companies who get nailed, you know, clearly weren't PCI compliant. But if you've done your due diligence and put the processes in place and actually have gone through the process of PCI in a good way and just made some bad judgments on gray areas, that's where I think there could be some legal battles coming in the future.
Right. So the kind of the last step here of action plan, so let me back up and just refresh, right? So again, you want to start with those meetings, get collaboration, get an audit of what you got, baseline, start building that legal defensibility platform, and then the term that the term of art I think that Dave used here was memorializing the positions in proof. Get that documentation in place. You know, so again, so you can produce something that shows the quality of your decision process, right?
Right. I mean, you want to also be able to show these are the industry standards that apply in our industry. These are the peer standards. We've put measures in place that address these. We've addressed, we're ISO compliant. We've complied with our own policies. All of these things, if you can show that and document that you've done these things, you'll be in better position if something does go wrong.
I have a specific question on PCI.
Sure.
You were mentioning about if you're compliant, then, you know, there's a new law that relates to if you're compliant.
Right. Well, actually, if you're just validated, you don't have to actually be compliant. But yes, if you...
And I don't know if you have any...
It's a big difference.
...virtue on this, but what would happen in the case that you had a PCI assessor, say you were compliant, but then after the breach, something's looked into and they find some area that you actually weren't compliant?
This has happened.
There is a lawsuit on this issue involving the card systems breach. I view the assessors as kind of similar to accountants. Accountants basically go in and say, you know, these financial statements are, you know, consistent with the generally accepted accounting principles. PCI assessors can make a similar mistake to an accountant and make the wrong call, make the wrong judgment, make a wrong decision, and they may be liable, but of course, they usually have a contract in place with the customer that limits their liability to a certain level. So even if they did make a mistake, it's sometimes hard to recover from them.
There's been a lot of discussion around this just in the last couple of years as breaches have started occurring at companies that had claimed full PCI compliance.
Right.
And typically what we see after the fact is that PCI comes back and says, first of all, we're invalidating your compliance. Clearly you weren't compliant because you got breached. But then they are also, and they've instituted a whole program now to essentially decertify the QSAs and put them on a remediation path, essentially send them back to school, and then they come back, and I can't remember what they call the list of assessors, but there's a special name that they term assessors who have to go through a kind of a probationary period then for a couple of years to demonstrate their competence.
It seems like the business would have an argument that, well, we didn't dig deeper into that, we didn't find that issue because an expert had told us that we were
open. Right. The QSA quality definitely has varied a lot, and also ambiguity, right? What is, you know, how do you meet specific requirements? Because the policies is a good example. Aside from the very specific requirements that PCI stipulates that you must have in your security policy, what if that's all you have for your security policy? Right? What's the exposure? Well, clearly from a you know, best practices perspective, and I hate that phrase because it's the minimum, right? The lowest common denominator. But still, we would say as security practitioners, thou shalt do more. But from a regulatory standpoint, it doesn't really say anything more. Randy.
And sort of to build on that and to clarify, I hope, something you just said a minute ago, I think you were characterizing the outside world saying, if you've had a breach, therefore you were not compliant.
Right.
Which I don't think is necessarily true. Because of the ambiguity.
Right. Well, and this is part of the problem of things like PCI, right, is scope. So here's your scope. You have to secure this. And, of course, then there's the other 90% of your organization. Heartland is a good example where the breach did not actually originate in their PCI environment. It originated in other systems, which then got the intruders into the inside, you know, of the corporate environment, and then they were able to work their way around back-end-wise. And we saw this happen with other environments, too. TJX, right, the one of the first big breaches. How did that occur? Well, despite all the misrepresentations in the media, there was a believed office break-in, and a wireless access point got injected into the physical network up in the, above the ceiling tiles. Was that reasonably foreseeable? They came in and thought, oh, my gosh, we've been robbed. And then they were right. They certainly were getting robbed. Right? Robbed blind, just not in the way that we traditionally thought of that.
But yeah, to Randy's point, a security breach doesn't necessarily mean liability. And the problem, as I've pointed out, though, is your back is certainly against the wall after you've suffered a breach.
Yep.
And the problem with PCI is it's not hard to find a PCI violation of some sort.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a big organization. Because again, the QSAs, they only look at a certain scope of the organization. Mm-hmm. They actually take samples of the organization sometimes instead of looking at the whole organization.
Yep.
And that's
right. Well, but that's a problem with all audits of large, you know, any large audit is going to rely on sampling methods rather than exhaustive testing because it's too darn expensive to do exhaustive testing.
Right there.
In the past, when I worked in the financial industry, I ran into the similar issue where you guys are talking about, and I think part of it also falls on us as security professionals because it's quite easy to go out there and find somebody that says they are a PCI assessor, and once you dig into their process and how they do their business, basically it's a rubber stamp.
Right.
I have run into situations where, as one financial institution wanting to do business with another bank, up on looking at their PCI qualifications and who's doing PCI assessment for them, automatically mark too many red flags, and then you get into the battle of saying, well, yes, we're PCI compliant, but no, when you look at the results of your scan, you can't be compliant when you have FTP wide open to the world and you're a bank.
Yep.
Right. And,
you know, so some of it falls on the due care and due diligence internally to make sure that what you're doing, and this comes to some companies. Some companies, they just want to do it just because they want to get
They want the rubber stamp.
Right. They don't really want to actually gain the benefit of saying, yes, we are truly compliant with these security postures, and it's just a symptomatic
This is the level 3 merchant problem, really.
And this goes too small to
have a budget for it, and you're big enough to be a problem.
And this goes to the concept of legal defensibility, too. Some companies are not going to necessarily adopt this concept because it can be expensive. It can require you to really address things that maybe you've been putting to the side and not wanting to look at too carefully. If you're a company that wants to get rubber stamps so you can just continue to collect credit cards and you'll deal with the breach later, legal defensibility is not going to be for you. But if you're worried about actually minimizing the risk, you're going to avoid those situations that you just registered.
Just ask the liability. If you're doing business with another financial institution, you're also still on the hook because at the end of the day, it's your customers. You're going to have to deal with the issue.
But Google will take care of all that for us, so it's not a problem, right? Well, we're pretty much at the end of time here. So thank you for sitting through and enjoying this with us like we did.
Question. How many organizations are you actively engaged with helping them prepare their Google defensibility process?
Can we disclose that under privilege?
I don't know how many. I've done it. There's the comprehensive kind of process, and then there's like doing it in snippets. And I often do it where I do it. Oftentimes is vendor, like I said, vendor management. For a couple companies, I've done a broader look at it and working with them and their security teams to develop their policies, including a full-on policy review for inconsistencies and things like that. But you know, this I think this is still, you know, we're still at the beginning phases of companies going this deep.
I wrote an article on this for the ISSA Journal a year ago this month, and that's the first time that I started, and I blogged about it for, you know, starting in August of last year. So we have about a year of tracker. Now, by the way, defensibility from a legal standpoint is not a new concept, right?
Yeah, no.
Lawyers have been dealing with, you know, making defensible decisions for a while, but putting this into a security context, that's what's new. In this regard.
Frank, the other problem, and I think it is probably on the legal side that there's some major problems because a lot of lawyers are just, especially general counsel, not very, frankly, scared of technology. And they think they don't want to deal with it because they don't understand it, or they just have no idea how it impacts legal issues. This, I think, is also, though, changing because, if you read the newspaper every day, there are privacy stories, there are data security stories. It's basically become, with Facebook especially, it's become basically ingrained into basically everyone's consciousness now. And I think now more lawyers are starting to say, well, hey, you know, we've got these issues. We've got to start dealing with them. How do we, you know, who do we need to talk to within the organization? And then usually there's an awkward conversation between security and legal, and they realize they don't even understand what the hell each other does. But
If you have interest in this, by the way, particularly this confluence of legal and security, I really do encourage you to look into joining the ABA, and particularly our Information Security Committee. You do not have to be a lawyer to join the ABA. I am not a lawyer, and I am an associate member. And so, you know, if you want to engage in these types of conversations and really help drive not only, you know, towards public policy discussions, but helping educate the attorneys and the judicial, it's a great opportunity to get involved.
The committee is made up of, I don't know the exact numbers, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was 50-50 lawyers and technology professionals. And there's a listserv where there's often active conversation along these lines where basically walls, communication gaps and walls are being broken down. And I think our lawyers of our committee and security professionals in our committee are much better prepared to have these conversations that we're talking about internally.
And what's the most important thing about it as far as being an associate member?
You get a Hertz discount?
It's cheaper.
It's cheaper.
Cheaper.
Yeah.
I see.
Cheaper than having to pay the lawyer fee.
That's true. Yeah, being an associate is far cheaper than the lawyer fee.
So we don't make nearly as much money.
This is true. I don't bill at $500 an hour. That's for sure.
So that's it. I think we'll be at the cocktail area if anyone wants to have more conversations.
Thank you very much.